Hello and welcome to episode 93 of the Alfa Romeo Driver Podcast, brought to you by the Alfa Romeo Owners Club. I'm Guy Swarbrick, and this month I'm delighted to be joined by the club's longest serving member, Ron Smith. No longer based in the UK, and as we'll see, he wasn't when he joined either, but still a very active and enthusiastic member of the club. Good afternoon, Ron.
Hello, Guy. Nice to talk to you.
So I know your membership number is 190, but I don't actually know when you joined. Can you remember?
Yes, it's either 1967 or 1968.
Okay.
It's a bit, we're not actually sure, because when I joined, we were actually working and living in Turkey.
Okay.
Prior to that, I had no knowledge that there was an owner's club at all. We'd bought the car in Milan in 1966 and taken it back to the UK, where we found very, very little evidence of dealers in our area, which was Brockford in Essex, believe it or not. So I was forced into going down to Kenrods at Worthing for service and stuff, all the way from Romford. But shortly after arriving back in the UK, I was assigned a new project in Turkey, and we decided to drive down there. So,
okay. I assume that was your first Alfa.
That was the first Alfa, yes.
Yeah, okay. And we'll come back to Alfas later on. You said you weren't aware of the fact that there was a club, and then when you were in Turkey, you joined. So how did you become aware that the club existed?
There was a tiny little... We used to get the English papers sent out once a month. And in the Daily Telegraph advertising section, there was a tiny little paragraph, which I don't know how I picked it up, but it said, Alfa Romeo Owners Club, please reply if you're interested. So I did, and that's how I joined.
Okay.
I'm not sure. We were there in 67 and 68, and I don't have the records to show actually what year it was.
Okay. So given that your member number's 190, it was quite a small and cosy club at that point still.
Yes, there was only about 100 members, I believe. Yes.
Okay. So what was the club like from Turkey? So were you mainly relying on the, I guess by 68 it was a magazine, but quite thin?
Yes, we used 68, it was still a Romeo magazine that John Dooley and Guy Sweet used to run off. So we used to get those and nothing much else from the club. I used to get spares, etc., sent directly from Kenrods, and had quite a conversation, communication with the service managers there, Bob Bates and then Ian Sharp, over the years for sending stuff out to us. Yeah.
Even in those early days of the magazine, lots of technical articles and articles to help you keep the car on the road.
Yes, it was principally keeping people alert to model changes that Alfa were going to make or proposing to make, and do-it-yourself maintenance work, because that was what the new members of the club were really involved with. Yeah.
And I guess if there's no dealers and a small number of specialists,
that's right.
You either got to like it or you've got to like it.
Yes, exactly.
So how long were you in Turkey for? How long before you came back to the UK?
We were there twice, about a year and 18 months each time. We came back in 68 and then went back again in 68, later on in 68, and came back in 70. So, yeah.
Okay. And did you stay for a while when you came back in 70?
No, I was assigned to New York. And then later on, so I did 6 months there. And then later on, we went to Spain in 73, yeah.
So presumably you didn't take the car to New York?
No. I didn't see any Alfas in New York either. Interestingly, we didn't see any Alfas in Turkey. And there was no dealers in Turkey, of course, at that stage. So, yes, it was quite a lonely life.
Yeah. A little bit better in Spain?
Oh, yes, much better. When we got there, it was there were dealers in all the main cities. And, in fact, we bought a new Alfetta in Spain.
When we were there. That was the second car you owned, was it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay, and how long were you in Spain?
Three and a half years, yeah.
Okay. So in that period, so that's what, 5 or 6 years since you joined, what changes had there been in the club over that kind of period?
There had been, shall we say, steady progress, I think, in trying to introduce area sections. Very difficult at first, but you gradually began to pick up. Surprisingly, the monthly meetings in the steering wheel club went on until, 79 or something. I was quite amazed at that.
Which is actually not long before the steering wheel club closed, is it? I think it was mid-80s.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, what was that like? What was the steering wheel club like?
Well, of course, it was the hub and the centre for the BRSCC and the BRDC, because John Morgan ran it for a while, and Des Scannell was there. So when you turned up there, there was invariably there were faces you recognised surface. Some automotive connection, mainly competition, of course. And yes, it was all very good, lively chats there. Lots of, again, do-it-yourself help. John Clifton, who was the mechanical guru at that time, I remember he would bring a gearbox or a differential with him and show how to dismantle and repair the items and put it all back together, etc. So that was interesting. Lots of film shows. And then about once every quarter, they would have a cocktail party, which was to bring on the females.
Right.
So, yes, it was that was interesting too. So, yeah.
And in terms of section activity, so I presume you joined your native section in Romford rather than setting up a Spanish one.
Yes, there wasn't an Essex section at the time. The first one was... I think the East Anglia section, which Guy Sweeten promoted, we used to go to some of that stuff. But looking back through some of the magazines, it's interesting that the club wasn't big enough or financed well enough to run its own race meetings. So there were jaunts into sprints and hill climbs. And I'm not sure if it still exists. There was something called a combined one-make car club.
Right.
The one make car clubs, again, like we were at the time, were not big enough, used to get together and then could afford to promote a meeting somewhere. So, they got involved with that and ran several meetings there. I think places like Snetters and elsewhere.
So I guess that's a similar kind of arrangement to the one the Alpha Championship has with the 750 Motor Club now, where they organise it for multiple member clubs, effectively. Yeah. Yeah. The steering wheel club fascinates me because I think when I first joined in the mid-90s, I went to a London section meeting, which was in a pub up near Marble Arch somewhere. But we've managed to go in the 60 years from everything being centered around the steering wheel club in central London to no London section at all. And I guess that's a reflection of the size of the club and the geographical spread of the club, but also not wanting to be mad enough to drive into central London for a weekday meeting.
Well, I think there's a lot in that. But of course, I think the club was initiated by Dennis Judd and others who had pre-war experience of Alphas. So there was a group, if you like, of interested people who had prior Alpha experience. So we say that not more senior, but the 50-year-olds, maybe 40, 50-year-olds. And then there were the youngsters like John Dooley and Guy Sweeten, who was still at university at that time, at Cambridge, who were enthusiasts and bore everybody along on the crest of their enthusiasm. So that was how it all amalgamated. But it was amazing that once the steering wheel club meetings got going regularly, which they did every month, last Thursday, I think it was, people used to come from all over, and there'll be people coming up from Bristol for these meetings. I mean, you wouldn't get that happening now, I don't think.
No. So did people typically drive, or if you're coming up from Bristol, were you more likely to come by train?
I think most people would have come by train, but a few would have driven up, yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. Parking was a little bit easier, I guess, in those days, but probably still not brilliant. Again, I worked in Soho in the late 80s, and even by then I tried to avoid driving into the office as much as I could. It was a bit of a nightmare. So we're at the mid-70s now. Steering Wheel Club's kind of coming to the end of its life. What would you say was the next kind of wave of changes, the next evolution of the club?
You can check this out better than I can from the population records of the club over the years. But I believe there was a surge of interest through the 70s, probably because of Alpha's success in competition and all the advertising they were getting from that. And they were also, of course, producing a range of vehicles which a lot of people could afford, if not new, certainly second-hand, from the 105s through the, even up to the Alpha Suits and the Alpettas and stuff. So there was a lot of that. And I think a lot of the success of the club has been influenced by the success of Alfa Romeo itself. When they don't produce cars that are satisfying to the majority, like 33s and Arnas and stuff, Alpha 6s, then, you don't get much of a response from people.
No, and I think we've kind of bucked that trend in the last 3 or 4 years because sales have been really low, but the membership's been growing. But I think probably the biggest example of that was the 156. I think membership grew dramatically once the 156 got to sort of 4 or 5 years old. So once people were having to maintain them themselves and looking for kindred spirits and support, we definitely saw a boost in membership then. We mentioned in the intro, you're not in Romford anymore, are you, or Turkey or Spain? Where are you currently sitting?
We're in New Zealand.
Okay. In fact, that was that was where we first met in a chapter meeting in Auckland.
That's right.
Yeah,
we emigrated here in 2010.
Okay.
I retired in 98, yeah.
So we'll come back to New Zealand in a minute because apart from anything else, it's the New Zealand Owners Club's 50th anniversary this year, I believe. I'm trying to arrange another trip out for that. So we got to the kind of 80s and some of the changes that were happening there. What was going on in your life between then and emigrating in terms of cars and involvement in the club?
We were at home for a few years and acquired the first person now. Then 83, I think it was, 83, 85. I went to Saudi Arabia for 3 years, so that was 88 or 90 when I came back. But then I was in the UK all that time. Then we started to acquire more Alphas. So at one time we had the 1975 2-litre Julia Spider. We had a couple of Alpha Sprints, Alpha Sud Sprints. I had a Alpha 90 and...
I'm glad there was a sprint on this or a couple of sprints because we have this kind of informal rule that we don't let people on the podcast unless they've owned an Alpha Sud Sprint. There was a pattern for a while that nearly everybody who came on, it was their first car, which was the case for me. But
I had two Alpha Sud Sprints, one of which I converted into a Pelham kit car for my son.
Okay.
The second one we had. And then we had the Alpha 90 and the Julia Spider, which was a beautiful car. Got wrecked in a Tesco's car park by some poor driver.
So that's an ignominious end anywhere, but Tesco's car park seems to be particularly...
Right. Yeah, my wife tells the story that she was sitting in the car when this guy smashed into her and was a bit shaken up, and then all these people came running over and all these young fellas came up and stood around and said, "Oh, what a shame to such a beautiful car."
Other than, "Are you all right?"
Didn't know.
Brilliant. So you had quite a collection by the time you emigrated. How much of the collection came with you? Or did you have a big sale?
There is another car in history, the original 65 Julia Sprint GT that we scrapped in 1996, I think it was, because it was, the body was too rotten. I'd been away for a few years and it had got stored under a tarpaulin, but outside, and it was rotten. So we took all the mechanicals out of it, and I built it into a Ginetta G27.
Okay.
And we brought that with us to New Zealand, as well as the later 1966 Julia Sprint GT that we bought.
And how straightforward is that process? And I guess that probably changed since you brought yours over, but was it relatively easy to bring a car over?
Well, it is if you emigrate.
Okay.
The chattels. But recently it's been getting more difficult because they've been stiffening up the rules on which cars you can bring in and all the rest of it for various. But there's still a lot of people doing it, and there's cars appearing all the time from different places.
Okay. And any thoughts about the changes you've seen with our club since you moved to New Zealand? Because there's been quite a lot happened in the 15 years or so you've been away.
Yes, that's right. Well, it seems to be a huge organisation now. There are, I don't know, 30-odd sections or whatever it is. So, yes, it's much bigger, probably more balanced and easier maintained operation than it was when it was, struggling with just a few people. Yeah.
And you talked about the variety of cars you've had. So you've had transaxle cars, you've had 105s, you've had AlphaSud-based cars. One of the things that I've kind of noticed, so you talked about the origins of the club, and my understanding is it kind of came out of the VSCC and a feeling that post-war alphas weren't really accepted as being real alphas by a section of the membership. And we kind of seen cycles of that where the AlphaSud comes out and there's a group of people who think that a front-wheel drive car made in the south of Italy is not a real alpha, and then the Fiat ownership and the people. So any thoughts on what is a real alpha and how well you've seen new generations of member accepted by the club?
Yes, I think it's easier for you to understand if I explain some of my background. Why I was brought up in Dagenham,
right?
In the 50s and 40s, 50s and 60s. And in Dagenham, the dominant influence was the Ford Motor Company. And cars. And ever since I can remember, I wanted to design motor cars. So when I got the opportunity, when I was 15, I was at technical school. I left school and joined Ford's apprentice scheme. Spent 3 years there and got promoted up to their, they called a scholarship course, which was a design course for where you did higher nationals and also were taught transmission theory, design, engine design, suspension, calcium, bodywork, and all the rest of it. So, training to be a basically a design engineer for Fords. And then at the end of that, I got a surprise. I was awarded a technical state scholarship and went off to Durham University and did a mechanical engineering degree. And whilst there, my eyes were open. There were other things besides Dagenham. And when I got an offer from an American oil company to join them, and looking at the piss poor offer that Ford had made me, I decided to go with the American oil company. So all the time we were overseas working in the oil industry, I still had this hankering for design. And of course, all the lads who were on the scholarship course were impecunious enthusiasts. And it was, don't forget, it was the Chapman era. Yeah. So we all wanted to add lightness and just have lightweight, well, Ford cars. And all the time, Fords were trying to train us to take fractions of a penny off a cast iron motor or a cart sprung suspension. Here's Alfa Romeo with elegant designs, light alloy, engines, 5-speed gearboxes.
Cost no option, even if it bankrupts the company again.
Well, yeah, but that was the epitome of design. That's what you hankered after.
Yep.
That's always been with me, which is why I've always favoured light cars, lightweight cars, rather than big hip. I've never had anything more than the biggest engine we had was of course the Busso engine in the Alpha 90. So
yep.
Yes, I've always been a guy after the nicely proportioned 2 litres or 1.6 litres or something. Yeah.
Yep. And any Alphas that you always wish you'd owned or anything you'd like to add to the garage now?
Oh, yes, yeah. 33 Stradale, of course, comes to mind.
Yeah, yeah. You and every other member, I think.
Yeah. I always regret having to sell the Alfetta Saloon. We only had it for 14 months. It was a wonderful vehicle, especially for a family. It was the epitome of design with integrated gearbox, rear axle, Didion, 1750 engine. It was really a great car. We drove it around Europe and it was magnificent. But within 12 months, there was rust coming through around the windscreen, around the rear screen, on the wings. And it was just, you know, the preparation was just hopeless. So regrettably, I sold it before it got too bad.
Yeah, I think the Alfetta Saloon made the papers here over the weekend in a feature in one of the Sundays about Britain's rarest cars on the basis that they claim there are four left. I'll have to check how many left. I think there's slightly more than that, but it is of that order. It's, you know, if it's not four, it's six. It's not, which is
a couple here in New Zealand which are in reasonable shape, but that's all.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the New Zealand club. How's that kind of organised and set up? And
in a similar manner, with sections, but they're much more autonomous than I remember anyway. So there are something like, I think it's 10 or 12 sections, six in each area, in each island. And as a proportion of the percentage of the population compared to the UK, they're about twice or three times as good as the UK club.
Yeah.
Simply because there's so few people here. But it's very strong competition-wise. They run a similar thing to ARCA with the an Alpha Championship. Lots of people involved with that. Very, very active running runs and events, weekends and stuff. I run race meetings at Manfield and Taupo. So, yes, it's a very active club, and they hold what they call the Festa Annuale, which is the annual general meeting with a great, like, plus National Alpha Day, all rolled into one, over a weekend. And they hold that every 2 years, and they hold two of those in the North Island to one of those in the South Island, because there's less people there. So, and, yes, as you said, it's the 50th anniversary for them. This year, so there's a big Festa di Oro in Wellington this week.
It's October, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, we just booked our accommodation for it because it's very tight. Yeah. It's a very, very lively and well-based club. Yeah,
yeah, I hugely enjoyed my meal with the Auckland chapter. That was a fantastic evening, and I still keep in touch with a couple of people that I met on that evening through Facebook and things. So yeah, really good. And you still come home fairly frequently, I think, don't you? And manage to pop into an Alpha event or two while you're home, or not home, but back.
We have done in the past. And of course, when was the last one that Ken Carrington ran? We bought a Twin Spark Spider just for the event and came over for it. Yeah. Yes, we are coming this year in August, so we can be at Vista.
And I guess that's what one of the advantages of being in the Southern Hemisphere is you can come to all of our events and go to the New Zealand events, and they're all nicely four or 5 months. Yeah, in the sun and 4 or 5 months apart, so there's no calendar clashes.
Right,
brilliant.
Yeah, I was reading recently a bit more on Italian history, the problems with the Italian state since the Second World War. And when you start to look at what Alpha's problems were in relation to the Italian state, it's no wonder they had problems.
And I think a lot of those were kind of some of the same problems that we had in the UK, but just amplified 10 times. So the kind of the labour relations and all of those things in the factory.
In the 80s, they had the problem with the terrorism and the Red Brigades murdering their prime minister, and then all the problems in Sicily, all the judges getting murdered, etc. So it didn't help make a stable state at all.
No,
all the problems after the. I mean, at one time, I don't know if you remember it, most of the or a great proportion of the domestic appliances that were available in UK were actually made in Italy. Remember the name Indesit and Zanussi or somebody they had. But they didn't capitalise on that, and it all fell apart. And
most of those are now owned by the Americans, aren't they? Owned by Whirlpool.
Yes.
So I was brought up the other side of the Thames Estuary from you. So I was brought up in North Kent, And we had a very weird period where I was a Gillingham season ticket holder, and we were sponsored by Zanussi. I still never worked out how Zanussi managed to pick a mediocre third division football team to sponsor, but there wasn't quite a Newcastle and Saudis and Manchester City and Abu Dhabi kind of injection of cash, but it did make a difference. We've looked back over the best part of 60 years. I won't ask you to look forward another 60 years, but what would you like to see the club do differently or more of in the future?
Well, it's difficult to suggest things because it's so much influenced by other events, shall we say, that not least being what are Stellantis going to do? You know, at the moment, they're producing rounded brick cars like everybody else. Are they ever going to produce an elegant car like the 105s and the Suds and things that which appeal to people who haven't got £50,000 in the bank to buy a new car?
Yeah.
Problem though is of course the restrictions are placed on design or the impositions on design by others, notably for safety and then for providing armchair comfort in a, shall we say, lounge comfort in a car.
I mean, it's difficult to do both of those things and add lightness.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking back the other day, we were talking to somebody, they were complaining about they couldn't reach their screen too easily. And I said, Jesus, where are the safety people saying it's dangerous? Play about on the screen.
There's an element of the new technology still having the same old problems. So I've got a Tonale, and one of the features that I would never have dreamed of wanting is it's got a heated steering wheel. But the Italians, being the Italians, have not mapped left hand drive to right hand drive. So I've got a screen in the middle of the car, and there's a pair of icons on either side, one to control the heated and cooled seat and one for the heated steering wheel. But the heated steering wheel one's on the passenger side because that's the driver's side. They've not even in the software, they've not bothered to move it from one side to the other, which is kind of the same sort of problems we've suffered for most of Alpha's history in the conversion from left-hand drive to right-hand drive. But
I cast my mind back to some 70-odd years now when I took my driving test. I was taught by the Ford Motor Company chief tester, come whatever. And when you went out for a road spin with him, you had to concentrate on the road. You weren't allowed to converse because that took your mind off the road. You would look for bumps in the road and the attitudes of other people and the way they drove and all the rest of it. So your mind should be filled with that and not with any other extraneous thing. he turned in his grave and
well, and that kind of defensive driving is probably more important now than it even was then, because the roads were a lot quieter.
Exactly.
I guess cars do stop a lot better now than they used to.
Oh yeah, that's right. But,
or in some cases, they stop now and they didn't used to.
Yeah. Yes, it's been a big change in what's been happening.
Just with your engineering hat on. And going back to that conversation about elegant, smaller cars, do you see them ever coming back, or do you think the kind of battery platform sharing is going to make that increasingly difficult to do?
Yes, I agree with you. It will be increasingly difficult for the majors to do it. The only way it will happen, I think, is if there are some specialists who are set up to do to produce such vehicles. But then, of course, it comes at a cost, as alcoholics have shown with their alpha bars, etc. It's lovely, nice to have vehicles, but they still come at a cost.
So it's about £50,000 a kilogram, as far as I can see, for their Lightning.
I don't see any of the big companies thinking there is any money to be made in going down a different path to what they're all doing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's money to be made out of things like the 33 Stradale, the new one, but for a very small number of people and in very large lumps of money.
Yes, that's right.
I noticed your Philippe Imperato's got, you know, he talks excitedly about the fact that the opportunity around electric cars is that because the drivetrain is so simple, effectively you end up with a skateboard that you can put anybody on top of, and you can play around with the suspension on the four corners, but because all of the powertrain is effectively in two small lumps at the front and rear and the battery pack at the bottom, you can have a car that's a massive three rows of seat SUV for Ram in the US or Chrysler or whoever, Dodge, and can also be a two-seat sports car for the European market. What they haven't done yet is to produce anything other than the SUVs. So, and I don't think...
The bottom line, what it produces against the top cost. Yeah, that's right.
Brilliant. That's been fantastic. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and thanks for joining us, and look forward to seeing you at National Alpha Day.
Good. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about the last 60 years.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that trip down memory lane, and indeed into the future, as much as I did. We'll be back in 4 weeks' time on Sunday the 5th of May, when we'll be looking back on the launch of the new Alfa Romeo Milano, which takes place live on YouTube at 4 p.m. on the 10th of April. Episode 94 will be available to download from 1:30 p.m. from iTunes, Podbean, Podcast Addict, Spotify, the club's website, and everywhere else good podcasts are found. Until then, stay safe.